You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Rick Britton is a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes history-related lecture classes in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Thursday, September 15th, 2011, the second lecture of a new series entitled Virginia History 201, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, A Dynasty of Friends, was delivered by Jeff Looney, senior editor of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson, Retirement Series. Call Jefferson through the eyes of his family. Editor Looney's talk uses anecdotes culled from the many Jefferson and Randolph family letters and presents the human side of the Sage of Monticello's life after his retirement from public office. This is part two of five. Here's Jeff Looney.
Thank you. And can you hear me? Shout if you can. Okay. Before I start the actual talk, I always, because I'm a documentary editor, I start by giving a Jefferson quote of some kind. And in honor of being in the Senior Center, I thought I would just describe one document in which Jefferson has what can only be described as a senior moment. To set the stage, so it is April 1826. Somebody sends him back a letter, and he says, "You sent this letter to me, but it's actually a letter to somebody else." So he's actually misaddressed the letter. The guy sends it back. Now Jefferson needs to write this gentleman who sent him the letter back a thank you note. So he writes his thank you note to this gentleman, and he says, "I correct my blunder of misdirecting my letter to Mr. Madison by enclosing it to him this day. I committed a similar one while in Paris by cross-directing two letters to two ladies, out of which scrape I did not get so easily." Which does a great job of giving the lie to the idea there is no humor in Jefferson's letters. He suppresses it sometimes, but he has a marvelous sense of humor, and it's wonderful when it comes out. Well, title of my talk, Grandpa Decided That It Would Not Rain, Thomas Jefferson Through the Eyes of His Family. Thomas Jefferson has been studied so long and in such detail that important new sources seldom come to light, but there are happy exceptions to this rule. In this talk, I want to introduce and give some background to the Family Letters Project sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, give some sense of the range of material it includes, and take a preliminary look at the way these documents can give us new information on Jefferson and enable us to reassess some of what we think we know about him. Now, Jefferson's letters to and from members of his family have been accessible for many years. Some of this material first appeared in his great-granddaughter Sarah N. Randolph's Domestic Life of Thomas Jefferson back in 1871. A century later, Edwin N. Betts and James A. Baer published a much more complete version in The Family Letters of Thomas Jefferson. And all of these documents are gradually appearing in the Princeton University Press's definitive edition of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson, which, as Rick said, is my project too. But these frequently cited works have largely confined themselves to letters written or received by Jefferson himself. Now, a different, very important window into Jefferson's world is provided by the letters of his children, grandchildren, and extended family resident in Monticello or the surrounding neighborhood. A great deal of this material has survived, and some of it describes Jefferson, his activities, and his conversations, especially in his last decade, as his grandchildren increasingly matured, wrote letters, and moved out of the house to receive letters from other grandchildren. At an early stage of our work on the retirement series, we realized that the family documents contained essential information and needed to be thoroughly surveyed. Dumas Malone cited a number of these letters in his magisterial six-volume Jefferson biography, including, for example, a letter from Jefferson's niece, Hetty Carr, to a relative reporting that the aging statesman turned white when he was informed that Monticello would have to be included in the lottery with which he hoped to pay his creditors in the last year of his life. More recently, Andrew Burstein and Cinder Stanton have used some of the better known groupings of this material to very good effect, but it had not hitherto been regarded as within the scope of the Jefferson papers themselves, and almost none of it had been accessioned by us. Furthermore, unlike the letters Jefferson himself exchanged with his family, virtually none of the remaining family material had been printed, and most of it had never been microfilmed, scanned, or cataloged in depth. We are now providing broad access for the first time through the Thomas Jefferson Foundation's Digital Archive on the Family Letters Project. This online companion to the Jefferson Papers Retirement Series has begun the task of locating, cataloging, scanning, transcribing, and publishing electronically the correspondence of members of Jefferson's immediate and extended family. Again, always excluding the letters by or to Jefferson himself that are already being dealt with. These FLP documents are prepared by Retirement Series staff and adhere to its standards for literal transcription and rigorous textual verification. We provide source notes, but in the interest of getting the material out quickly, we don't provide very much annotation as yet. With the initial emphasis on material from Jefferson's lifetime, the project will ultimately include the decades after his death, when the family disposed of his estate, published and then dispersed his papers, and wrestled with poverty, the disruptions of war, and the largely self-imposed burdens that dissent from Jefferson entailed. Full transcriptions of more than 500 documents are currently available on our website for free, and we add more regularly. The eventual total may number several thousand. Where we initially thought we need only obtain letters actually written at Monticello or Poplar Forest during Jefferson's lifetime, the range needed to be expanded on several fronts. Incoming as well as outgoing letters were crucial to understanding the correspondence. We found it necessary to define family very broadly enough to include the likes of Elizabeth Trist. A tireless collector of family gossip and a diligent letter writer, Trist had a grandson, Nicholas Trist, who eventually married Jefferson's granddaughter, Virginia. But the elder Trist became a frequent resident to and sometime resident of Monticello well before that. Furthermore, she elicited and disseminated important descriptions of Jefferson's activities and opinions, even when she was not living in his home. Long after Jefferson's death in 1826 and the family sale of Monticello in 1831, family members continued to reminisce about Jefferson's life and reflect on his legacy. They also provided a record of the family's history that is fascinating in its own right. Now, by including incoming letters, expanding the chronological range into the 1870s, and adding some correspondents who were more peripherally related to Jefferson himself, we have greatly enhanced its value, but also increased the scope of our work by an order of magnitude. So, how do these letters change our picture of the aging Monticello patriarch? Jefferson took great pains to manage the image of himself that appears in his own correspondence, and then to preserve this written corpus, which has always dominated our understanding of him. Reading letters between family members, unmediated by Jefferson's desire to control the way that others viewed him, changes the way we see him, and even our understanding of the way he saw himself. Consider, for example, the sickness of Jefferson's trusted slave, Burl Colbert, at Poplar Forest in the summer of 1819. Colbert had accompanied Jefferson and his granddaughters, Ellen and Cornelia Randolph, to his Bedford County retreat, and there fallen dangerously ill. On 28 July, Jefferson, Ellen, and Cornelia all wrote letters back to Monticello describing the incident. The fullest account came in a letter from Ellen Randolph to her mother. She reported that Colbert had been sick for several days before he stopped working, and that more time was lost before a doctor could be procured, that the malady was at first thought to be a simple colic, but it turned out to be an obstruction of the bowels, that they had tried laudanum and a warm bath, but the relief was only temporary, and that, quote, it appeared to me impossible for anybody to suffer such agonies for such a length of time without danger of inflammation and mortification, that, quote, I did not know what was necessary to be done. No help was at hand, and I thought very frequently, good God, if he should perish for want of assistance. She reported that Dr. Steptoe devoted 2 days to the case and saved Colbert by, quote, bleeding him until he fainted or very nearly fainted, that Colbert was still weak but had resumed work even though, quote, he cannot do much of anything as yet, and that, quote, I never saw anybody more uneasy than Grandpapa, and his constant anxiety by convincing me still more of his extraordinary value for Burl increased my own fears and feelings to a degree that surprised even myself. She added that Grandpapa, Cornelia, and myself make as complete a trio of ignoramuses as I do know. And I do not believe our three heads combined contain as much medical knowledge as would save a sparrow. I am determined to qualify myself for taking a degree as soon as I go home. Cornelia's somewhat shorter paragraph largely follows Ellen's version, but indicates that Burl had been ill for 3 weeks and adds that they were, quote, in terror every morning when we got up, lest we should learn that a mortification had taken place. But even if we had known what to give in such cases, we should have been afraid to give more than a dose of castor oil or a few drops of laudanum. This we did, but the castor oil had no effect, and the laudanum only gave temporary relief. Now, the accounts of the Randolphs are revealing. Jefferson's abiding distrust of the medical practitioners of his day and of practices like bleeding is generally accepted. Burstein has recently argued that Jefferson was deeply immersed in medical literature and that this influenced his language and behavior in crucial ways. But now, in 1819, his family observed Jefferson desperately awaiting a doctor when a favorite slave fell sick and remarked on his great ignorance of medical lore. The picture can be reconciled with Burstein's emphasis on Jefferson's more theoretical grasp of medicine, but at the very least, the family letters modify and add nuance to such a discussion. Meanwhile, Jefferson himself described the incident to his daughter in a single sentence. Quote, we have been near losing Burl by a stricture of the upper bowels, but he has got about again and is now only very weak. Excessive reliance on Jefferson's own correspondence would give us no hint of his emotional distress at Burl's brush with death, nor of his helplessness and dependence on expert medical advice, nor of his willingness to permit bleeding as a remedy and its apparent efficacy in this case. Information about Jefferson in the family papers can be broken down into several categories. Abundant references to his whereabouts, activities, habits, and illnesses appear, and some are otherwise undocumented. After one especially grueling trip, Cornelia Randolph reported in April 1821 that the exhausted party had arrived at Poplar Forest, only to learn that the caretaker was 16 miles away with the keys. Burl Colbert managed to shake open the front door, but the bedding and food were locked away inside an interior room. Furthermore, a hard winter had killed off most of the garden. Jefferson and his companions had a meager meal consisting of leftovers from their traveling provisions and whatever food could be found after several hours of searching for anything overlooked when the house was shut up the previous year. They were about to stretch out on a mattress with a single blanket when, quote, the keys arrived, and in a moment we had tea and wine and comfortable beds. We tend to think of Poplar Forest as the house to which Jefferson retreated for solitary contemplation, but at least when he took his granddaughters along, Jefferson indulged in a great deal of visiting. In August 1819, the family accepted from 3 to 5 invitations a week. At Monticello, the family letters provide the best evidence on the size of the White household. Elizabeth Trist wrote her grandson in September 1819 that, quote, the present family consisted of, quote, Mrs. David Randolph, a protege of hers, a young woman who sits in her chamber and sews, is waited upon as a lady, Mrs. Hackley, her 2 daughters, and her Spanish assistant, Mrs. Carey, and 3 daughters, and her son, with James every evening from Charlottesville, with Ben and Lewis, noisy enough, and a young lady, a friend of Ellen's from Richmond, by the name of Braddock. Trist neglected to mention herself, Jefferson, Jefferson's sister Anne Marks, and his daughter, son-in-law, and additional grandchildren. The total White contingent at Monticello at this time was something like 20 people. As Trist put it, quote, we muster strong. The family also reported with exasperation that as many as 10 to 15 visitors a day were casually passing through. The effect of this hemorrhaging hospitality on Jefferson's increasingly shaky finances is hard to quantify, but it was surely profound and deep. Jefferson allowed the sculptor John Brouwer to take his life mask in October 1825. The ex-president soon described the encounter to James Madison in humorous terms that nonetheless suggested that he had found the experience painful, and he later honored Brouwer's request for a testimonial in which he underplayed his discomfort even more. Jefferson was glossing over a near tragedy. His granddaughter Virginia's fuller account was vivid and indignant. Quote, "A vile plasterer who calls himself an adept in taking the art of taking likenesses in plaster came here highly recommended and prevailed on Grandpapa to submit to that horrible operation of molding the plaster on his face and even enclosed casing the whole head and throat, which really seems like burying alive. Grandpapa was too weak to undergo it in the first place, and in the second, the man was so very unskillful that he suffered the clay to get too dry before he removed it, and then, not having put oil enough on to prevent its adherence to the skin, the operation of removing it became one of the most excessively painful that it is possible to imagine, and so slow withal that we expected Grandpapa to faint from exhaustion before it was completed. And so I still believe he would have done if he had not been enduring tortures that prevented it, and which wrung from him, patient as he always is in suffering, groans and even hysteric sobs. In short, the life mask very nearly became a death mask." The family letters provide a far better source for Jefferson's health than his own correspondence, since he was generally somewhat reticent on this point. From the family letters, we learn that in 1819, Jefferson had a violent attack of rheumatism that made his hands and feet very swollen, and that he applied flannel to the affected parts. His granddaughters also give full accounts of the fracture of his left arm he sustained in November 1822 after falling down the terrace steps at Monticello, of his slow recovery, and of a rapid swelling in the left hand in February 1823 that could have led to a dangerous rupture without the timely bandaging of the part by Dr. Watkins. We learn that a year before Jefferson's death, the family knew he was suffering from what they called an inflammation of the neck of his bladder that became worse when he sat up for a long time or rose frequently and was eased if he could spend much of his time lying down. His son-in-law thought that the problem had been caused by his frequent horseback rides to Charlottesville to oversee work on the University of Virginia. To ease the pain, they report that Jefferson was taking 85 drops of laudanum a night in September 1825 and 100 a night the following month, that he succeeded in cutting back to only 70 drops in April 1826, and that some family members attributed the eventual collapse of his vital powers to months of exposure to this opiate. Now, the family letters also document conversations with Jefferson or repeat opinions that can only have come from a recent conversation. Although this information is refracted through the mind and pen of the person repeating it, it is still invaluable, in part precisely because Jefferson did not himself record it and in so doing manage its preservation. In December 1810, Elizabeth Trist reported that Jefferson had learned that his grandson-in-law, Charles Bankhead, planned to sell his slaves in Mississippi. Trist quoted Jefferson as saying that, quote, "It would never do to destroy the goose, for that nothing could be done without hands, that he had better dispose of the land he had given to Anne, and that he, Jefferson, would provide for her." In April 1824, Jefferson added two gymnasia to his plans for the University of Virginia. Thanks to a hitherto overlooked reference in a letter from his daughter to Nicholas Trist, we now know that this idea occurred to Jefferson, quote, "during a fever that confined him upon the sofa. He immediately sent for Mr. Brockenbrough and gave him every direction as to the plan when he was actually so weak that he could not set up to draw it himself. Flanking the south side of the rotunda, the gyms leaked and were seldom used before being converted to other uses in 1841. As Jefferson's financial condition became truly desperate early in 1826, his family anxiously discussed its options. They considered selling Poplar Forest, but concluded that it would not yield enough money to settle his debts. At length, they concluded that the only viable course was to sell Monticello and Jefferson's remaining Albemarle County land and, quote, as many Negroes as would pay the debts, and moved to Bedford County, quote, retaining only the necessary furniture for that house and a small but effective household of servants. Up to this point, no one had had the nerve to advise Jefferson himself of these plans. And when they broke it to him, quote, the shock was, as we foresaw, dreadful. He said he had lived too long, that his death would be an advantage to his family. His grandson and business manager, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, quickly convinced him otherwise, that even from a purely financial perspective, his death would be, quote, a calamity of frightful magnitude for his daughter and grandchildren if his debts were not first settled. Quote, the first shock over, Jefferson became reconciled, and we were trying to look forward to plans of future comfort and improvement. But, quote, at that precise juncture, lying awake one night from painful thoughts, the idea of the lottery came like an inspiration from the realms of bliss to Jefferson, who got up at first light, sent for his grandson, and persuaded him of the scheme's merits. Without his family's letters, we would know nothing of the abortive plan to sell most of the slaves and move to Poplar Forest, nor of Jefferson's late-night inspiration for the lottery scheme. Ultimately thwarted by Jefferson's death 3 months later, the projected lottery reassured everyone until then. Indeed, while Martha Randolph expressed her doubts that the family could sustain itself on the remnant of property that would remain after the lottery, Jefferson himself proved fiscally incorrigible within weeks of conceiving the idea, admiring his granddaughter Virginia's new piano and stating that if the lottery went well enough to justify such a luxury, he would certainly buy another piano for himself. The family's description of Jefferson's opinions and conversations are always loving and respectful, but a touch of frustration or sardonic humor sometimes enters in. His taciturn and self-centered retention of control proved especially annoying. Granddaughter Mary Randolph commented to her sister Ellen in November 1825 that, quote, two English gentlemen came in just as we were about to sit down to dinner, but that since Grandpapa, according to custom, neglected to introduce them, I do not even know their names. The following spring, she reported that, quote, to our great annoyance, Grandpapa has resumed the practice of inviting students to dinner on Sunday, and we are today to have a company of schoolboy guests who, for any pleasure or profit we expect from their society, are not worth the additional trouble their presence gives. But Grandpapa wishes it. Shockingly, Jefferson did not see fit to tell anyone but his eldest grandson about the lottery plan. Martha Randolph wrote her daughter that, quote, my father never speaks of his affairs, and your brother Jefferson being absent, the first hint accepted, we heard nothing more till we saw the petition in the papers. Cornelia Randolph was only enabled to pass on news about a University of Virginia faculty appointment because Jefferson asked her to copy one of his letters containing news on this point, and Jefferson made such scribal appointments only when the polygraph was broken. Now, picking their battles with care, family members sometimes did get their way with Jefferson. His daughter Martha gleefully reported early in 1822 that, quote, I have at last succeeded in having my alcove turned into a closet, and you have no idea how much it has added to my comfort. I laid regular siege to Papa, who bore it in dignified silence for some time, but I gave it to him for breakfast, dinner, and supper. And breakfast again, till he gave up in despair at last. Now, the alcove beds that Jefferson preferred were stuffy, cramped, and too hot in warm weather, but it took a major campaign by Martha Randolph to gain control over her own bedroom's layout, even as she neared the age of 50 and continued to raise her dozen children. 4 years earlier, Ellen Randolph wrote her mother that, quote, I hope we shall be able to worry Grandpapa into having more chests of drawers made. When Burl Colbert was in health, he could overawe Jefferson on occasion. During Colbert's 1819 illness, Jefferson insisted, and this was in the summer, remember, Jefferson insisted that the family use a patented refrigerator, as it was called, a fur-lined icebox that everyone else seemingly disliked and distrusted. Ellen reported that the invention, quote, wasted our small stock of ice, and gave us butter that run about the plate so that we could scarcely catch it, and wine above blood heat. But on Burl's recovery, he soon scouted it, to use Aunt Em's favorite expression, and we have been quite comfortable ever since. So you have this picture of Jefferson, or Burl, coming off his deathbed, or his almost deathbed, and looking at this thing, saying, "Get that thing out of here." Jefferson saying, "Okay." The family evidently regarded Jefferson's confident pronouncements about the weather as something of a standing joke. Cornelia wrote in August 1817 that, quote, "Grandpapa decided at breakfast it would not rain." He was right that time, but 5 years later, Ellen stated that during a journey to Poplar Forest, quote, "The morning was lowering, and it was dropping rain before we set out. But you know Grandpapa, he was morally certain we should have," and here she puts it in quotes, so she's quoting her grandfather, "a cool, agreeable day for our journey, so preferable to traveling through the hot sun." About 9 o'clock, she goes on, "it began to rain violently. We were exposed 2 hours and a half, until at half after 11 o'clock, we were glad to take shelter in the filthiest of all filthy places and remain until the next morning." And there followed a passionate diatribe about the, quote, "horrors which we witnessed at Flood's Tavern." Clearly, the family letters described Jefferson's activities and expressed views, but his was such a commanding presence in the life and imagination of his surviving daughter and Randolph grandchildren that their own expressions of opinion can also be studied for additional clues to Jefferson's attitudes. Consider, for example, his probable influence on the Randolphs' religious views. In May 1822, Cornelia described at length her reaction to a recent diocesan meeting in Charlottesville. She heard a sermon by William Meade, the leading evangelical in the Virginia Episcopal Church, and later its bishop, and admitted that although she could, quote, "never think his doctrine anything but monstrous," the man himself had impressed her favorably as, quote, "one of the purest and most passionless of mortals." She also contrasted a commonplace but rational sermon by Bishop Richard Channing Moore with the arcane efforts delivered at the same meeting by his associates, adding that, quote, "the bishop brought forward all the arguments that the Trinitarians generally use in support of their doctrine, and did not speak so lightly of morality as the others did. They seemed to consider faith in what they or no one else ever pretended to understand the only thing needful for salvation. He said merely that morality alone was not sufficient." When Dr. Whitaker contemplated a visit to preach the Unitarian doctrine in Charlottesville in 1824, Virginia Randolph wrote that, quote, "I suppose our going to hear him will depend upon Grandpapa's wishes. Mama objects because she thinks it will scandalize our neighbors, with whom we already stand suspected." The following year, her sister Cornelia attended 2 Presbyterian sermons during a meeting of a synod in Charlottesville, opining afterwards that, quote, "these men are all so fanatical or so hypocritical that I have no patience with them," although one was, quote, "very impressive in spite of the superstition of the principles he taught." One suspects that the Randolph grandchildren picked up some of these views from Jefferson himself. Similarly, the family's expressed opinions on slavery probably derived in some measure from Jefferson. Martha Randolph wrote Ellen's new mother-in-law in July 1825 that, much as she regretted Ellen's move to Massachusetts on personal grounds, she could only rejoice in its many advantages, the greatest of which was, quote, "being removed from a land of slavery. Painful as it is to give up a child, I have never been selfish enough to wish for one moment to entail upon them that greatest of all evils, one from which I shall never have it in my power to escape, nor can ever be reconciled to." The sale the following month of Virginia Trist's slave Susan at Susan's insistence distressed the whole family, Randolph family, and revealed that Susan had been permitted to veto several other purchase offers. She agreed to this one after several meetings with the purchaser, Mr. Cage, a Mississippi planter, and Martha Jefferson Randolph commented that the fate of Sister R's maid Sally has turned the head of every decent-looking girl in the state. They all look to New Orleans as a paradise, for they have only to show themselves to become at once ladies. Earlier, when Burl's wife Critta died, Ellen Randolph expressed her sorrow at the loss of someone who had been her nurse as a child, and in the same letter, rather in the manner of someone who sought a cherished memento of a deceased friend, asked her mother for one of Critta's children as her own slave, adding, however, that she would withdraw her own claim if Burl, quote, should be averse to the distributing of all his children. Septimia Randolph was a special favorite of John Hemming's, and at the age of 11, she wrote him a letter to which his friendly reply survives. Hemmings was nicknamed Daddy by the Randolphs, and in 1816, Cornelia Randolph had given him an English dictionary. When the entire estate of Martha's bankrupt husband, Thomas Mann Randolph, was sold early in 1826, Martha Randolph exercised her dower right to claim for herself 3 old women and 9 small children, keeping them from sale a little longer, but only adding to her family's financial difficulties. In short, the Randolphs' actions and attitudes about slavery were as conflicted and contradictory as those of Jefferson himself. Even if we take Jefferson out of the picture for the moment, the papers of his family are extraordinarily rich sources for social, family, cultural, and economic history and studies of gender and race. A few further examples will suffice. The letters are full of insights about medical opinion and practice. At the age of 49, Jefferson's daughter Martha attributed her, quote, headache with violent palpitations of the heart, spasms in my limbs and back, and frequent fevers, to menopause, which she expected would last for several more years. Her daughters, on the other hand, asserted that she was getting her migraines from the chickens and the turkeys. Martha suggested that her daughter Virginia's facial eruptions resulted from suppressed perspiration and could be avoided by bundling up adequately in cold weather. The family felt that Anne Bankhead's death after childhood birth in 1826 resulted from overprescription of medicine by ignorant physicians that was tantamount to murder. But they set great store by Dr. Jenner's tartar emetic ointment, especially for liver complaints. The family letters detail the reading habits of Jefferson's female grandchildren, often guided by Jefferson himself, but also strongly affected by works that were then in vogue. Ellen Randolph read Virgil in the original Latin and found that in comparison, the Dryden translation she had previously admired was as different as, quote, a glass of rich old high-flavored wine and the same wine thrown into a quart of duck water. The granddaughters also read Appian, Livy, Plutarch, Rochefoucauld, Sir Walter Scott, the poet Thomas More, and the historian Millot. 19th century editors of Shakespeare often urged that earthier sections be excised in order to spare feminine sensitivities. But the Randolph women reversed the trend in 1819, discussing the best ways to prepare Macbeth for a family theatrical in such a way that their younger brothers would not be able to tell that the spicier bits had been omitted. One letter describes Christmas in the slave quarters as fully as I have ever seen elsewhere, indicating that it was generally a noisy time, that white family members were often called upon to write notes for individual slaves, and mentioning, quote, the fiddler as he stood with half-closed eyes and head thrown back, with one foot keeping time to his own scraping in the midst of a circle of attentive and admiring auditors. The letters can be quite amusing. In 1816, Ellen Riley reports to her mother on her unsuccessful effort to be frugal during a visit to several cities. Quote, I was tempted in Richmond by some very elegant merino shawls. Their price was $35. They were rather more fashionable, and I thought cheaper than the police I should get in Baltimore. In short, I bought one of them. I had not finished folding and unfolding, gazing and admiring, when a letter arrived, saying that handsome pelisses were only $25 in Baltimore. I was thunderstruck at the news and had to hold my shawl to the light, admire its beautiful texture, and reflect how gracefully on my return home it would fall about your shoulders, she's writing to her mother, about your shoulders on great occasions, before I could console myself for having bought it. So far, you will say, was not so bad, but the worst is to come. When I arrived here, I put on the shawl and sallied out. Everybody admired it. Mr. Todd declared he had seen nothing so elegant in the Parisian shops. The fashionable miller, Mrs. McDaniel, was in raptures, and said she had sold several, not as handsome, for $60. This praise was very grateful to me, but alas, it could not keep me warm, neither would the shawl. The spectators admired, and I shivered. And in the end, she wound up having to order a warmer one as well. The family letter's material documents the family's pride in its great patriarch, but also the burden that they thought this imposed on them, as when Cornelia Randolph remarked late in 1825 that, quote, "I wish I could do something to support myself instead of this unprofitable drudgery of keeping house here. But I suppose not until we sink entirely will it do for the granddaughters of Thomas Jefferson to take in work or keep a school. And we shall hold out for some time yet. Ours is not a galloping consumption, but one of those lingering diseases which drags on for years and years." The correspondence also provides an unusually detailed and candid view of the famously tense relationship between Jefferson's daughter, son-in-law, and eldest grandson as the family spiraled into financial disaster and emotional rupture, culminating in the one known account of Jefferson's funeral. Held 2 days after Jefferson's death, Thomas Mann Randolph, Jefferson's son-in-law, and Thomas Jefferson Randolph, his grandson, could not agree on who should tell the officiating minister that a large group of mourners was on its way from Charlottesville. Neither did. And so they glowered at each other from across the grave while the minister completed the service and left, just before 1,500 disappointed and angry people arrived up the hill on a hot day with nothing left to see. Only a fraction of the documents that will ultimately come under the scope of the Family Letters Project are currently online, but it is already clear the Jefferson scholarship ignores this material at its peril. Presented in documents he did not compose or control, the family correspondence documents some of his activities in new ways and more detail, and shows the humanity and failings of a man whose family loved him deeply, but revealed some of his weaknesses and foibles that he would probably rather have kept from posterity. Selection from this material will be put to good use in upcoming volumes of the retirement series of the Jefferson Papers, but we are pleased to begin making it immediately available to the scholarly community and the broader public, and it's online and it's free. And we eagerly solicit input on ways that its electronic presentation can be improved. Thank you. And I'll be happy to take lots of questions. Go ahead.
I have a question.
The question is, when I talk about this lottery as though you know what I'm talking about, why do I assume that? And the answer is, I should not have assumed that. Very late in life, in the last months of his life, when Jefferson realized that he was just totally hopelessly bankrupt and that they were going to have to do something or they were going to lose everything, Jefferson suddenly had this idea that he could approach the Virginia legislature and seek to have a lottery authorized and put up Monticello and a lot of the land around it as the prize in the lottery, which is a way to raise a lot of money. When you can't get somebody to buy it, you can get a lot of people to put up a little money in the hopes of winning the prize. So the idea was that they would have these prizes, a prize consisting of the lottery itself, but you get supporters and friends all over the country to buy tickets to this thing, knowing that this would bail them out. And it probably would have worked, but unfortunately he died just as they were kind of getting going on this. And when he was dead, then although it would have been equally meritorious to let his family, help his family out, there was no momentum for that and it stopped. And so that's why they wound up having to move out of Monticello and sell everything, because the lottery did in fact fail. That's a very good question, thank you. Go to Monticello.org and click on Research and Collections. And from there, I think the next step down is going to be the retirement series of the Jefferson Papers. And if you click on that, then you'll get to what's called the Digital Archive. And the Digital Archive is where the Family Letters Project lives. It's also, we've added to it, and it now also contains several hundred Jefferson quotations. And these are just kind of the usual suspects that we keep getting asked about. So we thought, When we're asked, we look it up and check it against the original and gave it fully literal transcription instead of the kind of things that have been reprinted too many times. So we've started adding as many of those as we get asked about, so that the next time we're asked, we can just have people look it up that way. And if you can't find it, you can get a card, and I'll make sure you can find it. Please. The question is, did Jefferson own any of what is now Pantops? Yes, he had four quarter plantations. His plantation at Monticello actually had sort of four plantations to it, and one of them was Pantops. Another was Shadwell, which included his birthplace. I don't have a mental map, so I couldn't swear to the shopping center being part of it. I think it is, but I know that there's a lot of what he called Pantops was part of his land. He owned about 5,000 acres in the Charlottesville area, and of those 5,000, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation has almost 3,000. There's still a couple of thousand that have become devoted to other uses. Please. The question is, what do we have about, did Jefferson have a lot to say about his visit from Lafayette, who came to Monticello in 1825, I think? He was here in the country from 1824 to 5, sort of joyriding around the entire country, giving full vent to what Jefferson described in a letter to somebody else as Lafayette's canine appetite for popularity. No. And it's true. I mean, you read about what he's doing as he's traveling around the country, and he's going city by city. Everywhere he goes, there's this enormous reception and keys to the city, and he just can't get enough of it. You know, this goes on for a year, and he's still sort of looking for more places to visit, I think. He comes to Monticello. The whole nation is watching and waiting because they know this is going to be a big moment. And they meet, they embrace, they're together for several days. I know there's material about it, quite a lot in our files, but I have to admit that I am in 1816 now, and beyond the fact that I know we've got plenty of files on it, I've now told you everything I know about it. I know they had a great conversation, and he stayed there for several days, but what kind of reminiscences he wrote or what we have in the family letters about it, I do not know. Yet to come. Stay tuned. The question is, what did Jefferson die of? And the answer is, it's debated. I have read more than one possibility. Some people think the underlying cause might actually have been untreated prostate cancer. He had this inflammation of the bowels that could have just gotten worse and worse. I think it's like a lot of stories in the past about people's medicine where we just don't have. The language then is not close enough to the language now for us to be really certain. What's great is that he was fully lucid to the very end, and his letters prove it. He was writing wonderful material right till he died. But one of the other things we're working on, which is a different talk by a different member of my staff, is the family or the visitor accounts, which is the sort of the yin to the family letters yang. We've been collecting as many of these as we could find because we also want to have fully literal transcriptions of all of these descriptions by people coming to Monticello. And some of the descriptions in the family letters and the visitor accounts are really kind of painful to read the last year or two, because he's really in a bad way. And they describe him sort of shuffling around, looking like he's in obvious pain the whole time. Let me ask Rick to come up and hand out something here. I did bring a handout for you to enjoy. And this handout is designed largely, I'll take any extras when we're done. There should be plenty. The purpose of this handout is to be a not too subtle advertisement for the value of what we do as editors. I always like to, I give a different talk where I just talk about what editors do and why it matters. And the examples I give include, to take a different example while this is getting handed out, we've probably all seen and enjoyed the movie 1776 or the play 1776, right? So in 1776, Jefferson is being persuaded by John Adams to write the Declaration, right? You with me? And the way he does it is he quotes Jefferson to Jefferson. He says to Jefferson, "For we are resolved with one mind to die free men rather than live slaves. Thomas Jefferson on the necessity of taking up arms, 1776, magnificent." And then in his odious way, he goes on to flatter him into writing the Declaration. Well, if you look at Volume 1, the original Volume 1 of the first series of the Jefferson Papers, you turn to On the Necessity of Taking Up Arms, and you find that, like the Declaration, on the necessity of taking up arms was written by committee. And the first editor sorted out which parts of that document had been written by Jefferson and which parts had not been written by Jefferson. And the part quoted in the musical was not written by Jefferson. The part, in fact, is better still. The part written, the part chosen was written by John Dickinson, who has a totally different role in the play as the arch opponent of independence. And so it's actually a great teaching moment, because in 1775, the radicals, in many cases, could not go the whole hog to independence. So he was saying very passionate stuff, but he pulled back from that when faced with the ultimate step of independence. So it's a good story, but it does show that editors matter. And a similar thing is, I've handed out for you a World War II bond-selling card. And this bond-selling card, as you'll see, includes on one part, you'd have to fold it to see how the card had worked, but it has a quote. And we will now open it to the floor and see who's the first hand up to tell me what's wrong, what's the quote from, and what's the error. The word is, the quote is from the Declaration of Independence. And the actual word is mutually. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our... It's the ending of the Declaration of Independence. It's the BAFO ending. Well, here we are in 1942 trying to raise money for a bond buying campaign to help the government. Somebody puts in this quote, but they were working a little too fast. And they say virtually. And of course, nowadays, that's kind of hedging it, It's like saying, not really, virtually, kind of, sort of, almost. So,
or we did it over the internet.
Or, yeah, exactly. And in fact, I Googled this expression, and I found a single hit on virtually pledge, and it was from 3 years ago, and it was somebody misquoting it, but probably misquoting it in the digital world, thinking it meant something totally different. So that's just for fun. But do we have any, go ahead. So the question is, how do we find these letters, and how are they preserved, and how do they come to us? So as a down payment for my full talk about editing Jefferson, I will say that the project began in the 1940s. In fact, it began in 1943 for the bicentennial of Jefferson's birth. It was kind of one of two great projects, building the Jefferson Memorial and starting a definitive edition of Jefferson's papers. And they finished building the memorial a while back, I understand, but we're still editing away. Well, the first thing they did was to try to get every known Jefferson document from every place they could find, and that's been going on ever since. The heavy lifting was done at first, but we're still looking and we're still finding. But from about 1,000 different collections, ranging from the biggest, the Library of Congress, right down to a single document that might be owned by a collector or a descendant, or Union College is connected, he has a single Jefferson document, things like that, on up. We wrote every place, and in some cases traveled every place over a period of decades to get every text. And that means, by a text, I mean, if I send you a letter and keep a copy, there's two texts of one document. Well, we wanted them all, both ends of it. And that's very important sometimes, because Jefferson will add a postscript after he takes it out of the machine. So you really got to try to get both ends to really know what he sent. So we get them from the Library of Congress on down. Now, how did they get to be at the Library of Congress? When Jefferson died, very, very deeply in debt, the most valuable thing in the entire estate was his papers. And they didn't have the luxury of donating them. So T.J. Randolph, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, ultimately did a deal to sell the public portion of the papers to the government. And he did, and that helped him a lot. Unfortunately, the government said the only way we can tell what's public and what's private is to take them all and then go through them ourselves and decide what's public and what's private. So they took them all, and then Randolph spent the next several decades trying to get them to give back the private portion. Ultimately, they did, and then they were distributed. The private portion was distributed among his the descendants, the granddaughters and great-granddaughters. And that's how various chunks wound up in different places. So the University of Virginia has a couple of great-granddaughters' portions. The second biggest collection is at the Massachusetts Historical Society, and that's because Ellen Wales Randolph married Joseph Coolidge, who became wealthy, or whose family became wealthy, and a couple of generations down the road, he bought some of the other portions and assembled them, so a fairly large grouping went to them. Well, ever since then, we've been trying to get more of this stuff, and for the family letters, which we had not gotten at all, we've had to go back to various universities and say, okay, we asked for Jefferson stuff, now we want Randolph stuff. But even now, when we're annotating documents, we can sometimes figure out how to find a letter we didn't have before, because then we know exactly what date and what correspondent we're looking for. And so that search continues. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Very good. Please.
This is a tough question to ask an editor question.
So the question is, as an editor, does the kind of work I do lead me to sort of develop an idea about Jefferson that might influence my work? I would say, in the first place, yeah, I'm human, and you spend all this time working on these guys, and I spend a great deal of my working day trying to avoid this trap, because I've seen other editors who become kind of unhealthily involved with their subject, and I could tell you some great stories about how other editors have become sort of so involved, like they vacation the same place the guy did, and they write annotation that's really designed to make their guy look right. In fact, there's a piece of annotation for an earlier Jefferson volume where the editor at the time was at some pains to write annotation showing Jefferson had not made a math error, when in fact he had. There's just no question in my mind that the guy overreached to try to avoid it. And why? You know, why do you need to show that your guy didn't make a mistake? So we try not to do that. The most important way I do that is to avoid interpretive annotation. Our job is to do what I tell my colleagues that we have a lean and mean annotation style. We avoid interpretation. We avoid citing secondary sources that are interpretive in scope. For example, if we've got a description of a fire in New York City in a letter, we're going to turn to a contemporary newspaper and give a brief account of the fire, how many people died, how many houses burned, to put it in context. We don't follow that up with a discussion of the secondary literature on colonial firefighting, which is somebody else's job. And more to the point, I think that most of our readers haven't been born yet. And if we start citing stuff that gets that's going to be superseded in a generation, then our work will also be superseded, or at least the good stuff will be embedded in this stuff that's obsolete. So that's what I generally think. Doesn't mean I don't develop my own interpretations, but I try real hard to keep them out of the volumes. And the other advantage I have is selection is one of the ways that you can have an interpretive bent. But we have the great luxury of being a pretty definitive edition, so we leave almost nothing out. If we leave it out, it's because it's a one-sentence letter of transmittal of some other letter, and even then we would note it. The goal is to include everything legitimately Jeffersonian, and by doing that, even if we have a letter where Jefferson looks pretty bad, and we've had some, we print them. And so mostly when you hear my interpretation, it's going to be in this kind of a forum, and I hope not in the volume itself. We don't ask for originals. We're not crazy. They're not going to give them to us. We work entirely from photocopies and scans. And we sometimes do need to see the original if we can, and then we'll send one of my colleagues up to the Library of Congress, or if it's within reach and this picture isn't good enough, we'll go look at it. But when somebody has an original, we beg them for a scan or a photocopy, and people are usually pretty good about it. They'll usually supply us that. And there's a quid pro quo. You know, an auction house will send us their copy because we're going to tell them what we know about it. So both sides benefit. But we still occasionally get through the mail or through the internet a document we didn't have, and we're excited whenever we can. Please. So the question is there writing about the slave whose name is Sally Hemings? And the question is, what kind of a footprint does Sally Hemings leave in Jefferson's papers? Almost none. This stuff was all verbal. There's an occasional slave list, something like that. I've had absolutely nothing descriptive of her to or from Jefferson. And Lord knows people have looked. We are including visitor accounts, and we did print a visitor account from a gentleman who spent some time visiting Jefferson Monticello and then went down the hill and talked to other people in the taverns below. And this guy Elijah Fletcher, has a visit with Jefferson. Then he goes down into town and talks to people. And he writes his father, and he says, "Well, the people in town tell me this story is true about Sally Hemings." And I don't, one story like that wouldn't mean much either way. But what I do learn from that story isn't so much whether the Hemings story is true or not. What I learned from that story and from similar things is that I believe that there's a lot of reason to think that Jefferson was not as revered in Charlottesville as we would think if we read Dumas alone. And I think that from stories like this, he goes down and people start bad-mouthing Jefferson. I believe this because if you look at Jefferson's experience in the law, he comes home from the presidency, he's involved in some lawsuits, he's involved in some arbitrations. So you get arbitrators, you get jurors, and they're always deciding against Jefferson. And in some cases, it's unbelievable how they're deciding against Jefferson. I mean, there's one of the Henderson incidents. The guy comes to court and says, "Well, I had this agreement that I could build a mill right through Jefferson's land, and I had this with my mother, and she gave me a piece of paper, but I lost it." So it goes to arbitration. They say, you must have had it. I guess that's okay. Well, I don't believe that that's a story that says the people were interested in giving Jefferson a fair shake. And it's understandable to me, because what do you have? You have Jefferson up on his mountaintop, eating his fine French, fine cuisine and drinking his wine. And, the people that he's acquainted with, friendly with, are going to love him, but not necessarily going to love him if you're in the kind of the lower 30% taxpayers. So, I think there was ambivalence. And certainly he was widely respected and deeply admired and loved by a lot of people. But if you read Malone, you think everybody just thought he walked on water, and I don't think that holds up. No. Question is it hard to read the handwriting of these letters? It is brutally difficult to read the handwriting of some of these people. Happily, Jefferson himself writes very good, very, very good handwriting. There's a wonderful comment by Edmund Bacon, who was Jefferson's overseer for quite a few years, in which Edmund Bacon says, "Thomas Jefferson and James Madison both wrote with a fine clerkly hand, but I could write better with my feet than Monroe." And I have to spend a lot of time trying to read Monroe, and there's others that Monroe looks pretty good compared to Wilson Carey Nicholas, so there it goes. Oh, maybe we should stop there. What do you think? But any other people, I'll take questions up here, too. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.